So what about when we use NFP postpartum? We all know about lactational amenorrhea. This was a consensus conference back in the 80s when they looked at the available evidence then, and they say women who are fully or nearly fully breastfeeding, haven't yet had a bleed, and the baby's under 6 months of age should have less than a 2% probability of pregnancy, right? And then that was confirmed with some subsequent studies, and I want to show you one of them, a large multi-country study run by the World Health Organization. It followed over 4,000 women in 7 countries, and 3,400 of them finished. And they were able to look at their breastfeeding patterns and whatnot, and they had 49 pregnancies in breastfeeding women who were not also using contraception, barriers, pills, and other sorts of things that may be going on. And when they looked at the unintended pregnancy rate by various definitions of the end of their amenorrhea phase, that's what all those columns are, you don't have to worry about what that means, they basically saw a very low rate in the first 6 months, confirming the less than 2%. But interestingly, over the 12 months, they also found a fairly low rate. Okay, and what I'd like you to remember from this, and the simple mantra I keep in my head, is it's about 2% for 6 months and about 8% for 12 months. Okay, so breastfeeding alone, if following these sorts of exclusive breastfeeding patterns, should give you about 2% and 8% around in that time interval. So when we look at NFP methods, then superimposed upon that, does it get any better or does it change it in any? Well, there isn't a lot of data, but there is some. Most of that, of course, is among breastfeeding women. We really have no data about NFP use in non-breastfeeding women in the postpartum phase. Okay, so it's another hole in our database. Doesn't mean it wouldn't work necessarily, but we don't have the evidence. And what we're talking about here is trying to make sure we're clarifying to the world what we do and do not know about NFP. And you've got to keep the influence of the override of lactational amenorrhea in mind when you're looking at this stuff. So here's a Billings study that was run in Chile. Most of these people were new to Billings when they were learning, and they were in the postpartum phase, which is kind of typical for what many of us may see as teachers, right? We don't have experienced people coming all the time. They had 50 unplanned pregnancies, and here's the unintended pregnancy rates broken out by time. Among the breastfeeding cohort, at 6 months, it was about 8%. That's for the non-breastfeeders, and it was about 2% for the breastfeeders. But is that Lamb or is that Billings? Don't know. To the woman, it really doesn't matter, right? But if you're looking from an evidence-based standpoint, what you can say specifically about the method, it does matter. And then the longer time intervals, there simply weren't enough people to even do a calculation, okay? There have been some other studies. Miriam Lavick reviewed this. And some of the other Billings study actually suggested that there might be an increased pregnancy rate postpartum among women using the Billings versus women not using the Billings. So we've got some conflicting data here about what's going on. Creighton application in the postpartum period. This is a subset of a larger study by Howard and Stanford. There were 31 breastfeeding women in the cohort. And I show you the unintended pregnancy rates at 12. So these are cumulative rates. So this is method-related failure would be perfect use would be the way to think about that. Somewhere in here are the elements that would make up what we would call typical use. But of course, the Creighton model has a completely different philosophy. That if you know the model and you have relations in the fertile window, they define that therefore you have undergone achieving-related behavior. Okay, so that's a difference than what other systems would usually ask couples at the beginning of the cycle, what are your intentions for pregnancy? And they would say, I'm intending to achieve or I'm not intending to achieve throughout the cycle here. Okay, so there's a philosophical difference there. And we can argue about that, but I'm not sure that that's relevant for this discussion. But you can see here the breastfeeding cohort, which is only 30 people, against the large and regularly healthy regular cycle cohort, you can see the numbers here. Now, are these different than one another? Don't really know. Okay. Certainly, if everything's used perfectly well, everybody complies 100% to the rules and regulations, then you can't achieve effectiveness. But in the other more typical situations, what's there? For symptothermal, there's not much either. There was one study among experienced symptothermal users who were experienced breastfeeding moms. This study was really focused on correlating the definition of fertility by the symptothermal markers with biochemistry. They used, before the days of Kirby Louise, they used some of these early markers. And what they found, that the main conclusion of the study is there, that the symptothermal method is highly sensitive but not specific. So it will find all of the potentially fertile days, but because it's not specific, it will have many more days that it calls fertile that from a biochemical standpoint really aren't fertile days, which means more abstinence than may be necessary, which is really what's motivated the Marquette folks to try and figure out how to use the at-home biochemical markers. They did have pregnancy outcomes, though. They had three pregnancies among these folks down here. None of them were before the first bleeding episode. Well, gee, that means lactational amenorrhea works. Right? Two of them happened shortly after the first bleeding, the third one after she ovulated two times. And in all cases, they said that the pregnancies were achieved in cycles where the method was not used appropriately. So I suspect, again, if you use it perfectly, it will probably work. How well it works when you use it typically, we simply don't know. There's not a lot of information. The folks in Georgetown have come up with a way to apply standard days postpartum. It's fairly onerous, but the data are actually pretty good. Okay, and what it is you use lactational amenorrhea until you have your first bleed. Okay, as soon as you notice first bleeding, you can consider yourself infertile for 11 days. Then you have to abstain until you bleed again. Okay, then that will be called, that second bleed would call your second cycle. And then from then on, until your cycles become regular again, the protocol says abstain from days 8 to 24. Okay. Applying that protocol to a cohort of women and following them for 9 months, they got typical and correct use rates that were comparable to what they found from healthy reproductive women. But needless to say, I suspect many women who have experienced the transition from breastfeeding to postpartum, there's probably a lot of abstinence associated with that. But the data are there. So, we've recently seen a good publication from the Marquette folks with their breastfeeding protocol. This is very encouraging. And again, it was breastfeeding women using the monitor alone protocol. Is that right? Yeah. So they had a correct use of just 2 unintended pregnancies per 100 women, so 2% over a year, which is very good. Okay. And a typical use of 8%, if you would, over 12 months, which again is good. Good. How much of this is lamb? How much of this is the model itself? Again, that's a difficult question to talk about. And again, from the couple's perspective, it's probably irrelevant. Right? They're trying to understand their fertility. But from an evidence base, yes, it is. So, evidence grades here. For lamb, I scored an A. Richard scores it a B. Grumpy old man, I guess. Among breastfeeding women, I think the data are actually really mixed. I mean, there's some evidence that it's there, but we don't have a lot of good solid evidence. And as I said at the front end, NFP use in non-breastfeeding women, we really don't have any evidence. It would be nice to be able to do that. But somebody needs the $500,000 in the cohort to be able to go do that.
My comment on that, why I'm a little bit lower, I think that amenorrhea through lamb or breastfeeding, that should be just cycle zero. That should be just 1-0, not per month use. So it inflates it while you're in amenorrhea. The big challenge when most people are getting pregnant unintendedly is the first 6 cycles, that transition from the first menses. Now, they say the first bleed. We are tracking bleeding patterns and things like that for many, many women who are using our breastfeeding protocol. Determining what is the first bleed is not always that easy. There's a lot of breakthrough bleeding, things like that, that people might be saying, well, it was my first menses and that. Well, then you're going to inflate it a little bit more. My doctoral student, Mary Snyder, is studying that. We have thousands of, well, we have about probably 500-600 women now, and we're looking at what's happening biochemically in regards to the transition through the first 6 cycles, but we also are tweaking our protocol. So that's some of the research we're doing. Effectiveness when used perimenopause. Well, there's not a lot alone about the use of NFP or fertility awareness during the perimenopause. However, it is a very fearful time because people have completed their families, they are wanting to get into careers, and also careers, they don't have a lot more energy, it's less healthy, and there's a fear of having children that might have chromosomal defects and things like that. So there's a lot of fear at this time. During this transition, menstrual cycle shortens but becomes more variable as menopause approaches, and I'll show you a little about that. Dr. James Brown said it's like the reverse of the variability with adolescence. Back in early 2000, there's a reproductive scientists got together and they came up with what is called the Staging Reproductive Aging Workshop, and it's called the STRAW model, and they have updated it. Actually, Dr. Nancy Rehm, who is a nurse physiologist, presented at our first human fertility conference on the first model of this. They have updated a little bit, and obviously as women get older, their FSH levels go up, trying to get those the last eggs and follicles to ovulate, but they don't go into perimenopause until they have a variability of their length of greater than 7 days. Normal variability is 7 days between length of menstrual cycle, but when they have it greater than 60 days, it's approximately 18 months before they actually go into menopause. And menopause is defined as having 12 months without any menses. However, they also have a part where they're looking at the menstrual cycle. They call it subtle changes in flow and length, variability greater than 7 days, and then greater than 60 days. So we're trying to look at not only the length, but we're trying to gather cycles and all the way through about 55 and what's happening to the follicular phase, the luteal phase, and to end menses. Obviously, the length gets shorter. The luteal phase, it's about the same, I believe, but the follicular phase gets shorter and menses gets a little bit less. Reasons for the perimenopausal transition, well, depletion of follicles, eggs. After 35, it really goes down. Increased levels of FSH, AMH, lower levels. Eggs and sperms are older, and the endings, there's little telomeres that hold them together. They just get all frayed out. And many, you know, if they try to get pregnant, it would be... they couldn't because of the embryo would not be a viable type of thing. There's also this estrogen loop phenomenon, but I'm not going to go into it right now. Background studies. They did a study with women 45 years and older, Orthodox women in Israel, and they found a 0.2% pregnancy rate. And most of the pregnancies were among Orthodox women that had multiple babies. So there's not a lot of people getting pregnant after 45. I talked to my OBGYN friend, and you know, they tried to think how many, and very, very rare. However, Anna Flynn did a study where 33% of women between 45 and 30 were potentially fertile. They were still having cycles, 61% in another study. Metcalf had 50% are potentially ovulatory. What does the World Health Organization say? 50% of women over 40 are potentially fertile, risk of pregnancy. 40 to 44 is about 10%, 2% for 49 to 59, and not zero for women age 50. Everybody knows I had a great aunt or somebody that got pregnant after 50. They also say in the World Health Organization that irregular menses and amenorrhea make the use of NFP impractical. That's a W. So my purpose is looking at, were there any NFP studies? There is no NFP studies looking at efficacy during perimenopause. Now, there's some perimenopause women in some of these studies, but there's not a larger study on it. When I first gave a presentation at the Catholic Medical Association in Philadelphia about 5 years ago, was on a panel, and the first question by a doc says, well, what is the efficacy for perimenopause? And I said, well, I think it works and all that, but I really didn't have a definitive answer. Well, we just completed a study, to look at the effectiveness of natural family planning for women age 40 to 55. It's a retrospective study, but they were entered prospectively. We have 150 women 40 to 54 years old. We looked over a 12-month unintended pregnancy rate with survival analysis. You can see the mean age and so forth. Mostly Catholic, again, white. 24% Hispanic. That's pretty good. So this is our results. We had four pregnancies, unintended pregnancies, one with correct use. So that was a 98% survival at 12 months, and six pregnancies per 100. Well, there was, three with typical, which makes it six pregnancies per 100 users over 12 months of use when you do the survival analysis. One unintended pregnancy was a 40-year-old woman with the first postpartum cycle. Again, they're going through, you know, the breastfeeding transition, so you have that mix there. There wasn't one pregnancy after 45. So our conclusion that NFP is highly effective, but is the efficacy due to diminished fertility, higher motivation? We are publishing a study on looking at motivation with our federal study where they were each couple at each cycle were looking at how hard and how much you want to avoid pregnancy, the man and woman. So if they go below 8, pregnancy rates are like go sky high. So motivation is so important. As soon as it starts dipping down, people get pregnant. You could look at that again, limiter or spacers. So we need more studies. We need much more people over 40 to look at this and also look at what's happening in cycles. And now Dr. Eckleshard and Leon France is looking at trying to find women who have menstrual cycles to be able to look at that transition. The reason we don't have a lot is because
sterilization.
So, our grades? I'm pretty consistent, so is he.
Okay.
How much time do we have?
Well, we're about 10 minutes till the alarm goes off.
Oh, okay. So.